This is a special feature programme in place of Midori House, which was first broadcast on the 6th of April 2012 on Monocle 24.
I knew she was a photographer, I just didn't know the extent of her work. I knew that she took pictures because she frequently did when the people visited. You know, she'd get her Rolleiflex out and take the most amazing pictures. But what I was totally unprepared for was her work in Paris with Man Ray, and also what grew out of that, her New York studio, her work in Egypt, and most strikingly, her work as a war correspondent and then a combat photographer.
She's one of these people who know how to take advantage of an opportunity, who can make the kind of split-second choice that has vast consequences. I admire such people.
I cannot think of another photographer that has come from such a colourful lifestyle as Lee Miller to be able to compare her to. She inhabited a world that is so different from the world that we inhabit today.
Lee Miller's life is like a portrait of the 20th century. She went from fearless gamine flapper in 1920s New York to become muse, studio model, lover and collaborator with the avant-garde photographer and artist Man Ray in 1930s Paris. As the Second World War was declared in Europe, she became British Vogue's correspondent on the front lines of the conflict. Embedded with the US Army, she captured the horrors of Dachau and the siege of St. Malo with a keen, surrealist eye. Her life continues to fascinate. This summer, an exhibition, Man Ray and Lee Miller, Partners in Surrealism, opens at the Fine Arts Museum in San Francisco, and a new book of the same name was just published, featuring essays by her son, Anthony Penrose. In this programme, A Surrealist Eye at War, here on Monocle 24, we look at the life and legacy of Lee Miller, the first surrealist war photographer. We start by heading down to Chiddingline, a small village near the southeast coast of England, to Farley Farm, where we meet Lee's son, Anthony Penrose. So we're driving through the South Downs in Anthony Penrose's enormous truck. And so over that hill is Glyndebourne.
Yeah, Glyndebourne Opera House, and it's a very important cultural institution internationally, but it is important for us too because it's a huge factor of employment there, and also it's a kind of cultural focus, and people who come to visit Glyndebourne also come to visit other attractions such as Farley Farmhouse and the various other places in the neighbourhood, which are really becoming, you know, helped by the presence of Glyndebourne.
And now we're heading for Farley Farm. How far is it from here?
Well, we're just passing through Ringmer now, and Farley Farm is about 4 miles, 4.5 miles from here.
And how long have you lived in this area for?
Well, we came here in 1949 when I was quite little, and I've really lived here ever since, although I've travelled widely and lived temporarily in other places. This has always been my home.
It's a beautiful spot. Well, I'm really excited.
Well, this is the village of Chiddingline, and we've just passed the signpost, which was made famous by Picasso. And you might have seen the Lee Miller photograph of Picasso standing by it, pointing most incongruously to the Chiddingline signpost. And that's just over there. And just up here, this is the old farmyard of Farley Farm. And here is the house, which is now a little museum dedicated to the work of Lee Miller and Roland Penrose, who were both my parents.
And how did they end up here in this tiny little village?
Well, they came here for a combination of reasons. First of all, my dad knew the area very well because as a child during the First World War, he had worked on a relative's farm just 4 miles from here. Then he knew it well from visiting the Bloomsbury people at Charleston, just only about 8 or 9 miles from here. And then, of course, it was very convenient because it was close to the New Haven port for the cross-channel services. And that was very important for both my parents because they were tremendously connected to France in particular, and it was important for them to be able to nip over and have their friends nip over this way too.
And tell me, I mean, I can imagine in the 40s and 50s, this is a very conservative little place. Do you think that your parents' friends scandalised the area?
It was wonderfully conservative. It was old England with a capital O, capital E, and unchanged in many ways. And my parents did create a bit of a ripple. But people were actually very well-mannered and very discreet in those days, and nobody made a fuss. And if my parents wanted to kind of indulge in egregious behaviour, then really it was regarded as being their affair and not anybody else's business.
And did they host lots of different artists and friends here?
Yes, many different artists came. There was, of course, you know, the ones who are internationally recognisable from that period, like Picasso and Miro and Maxi Ernst and Man Ray, of course. And then there were the young guys who were very exciting, people like Kenneth Armitage and Richard Hamilton, that sort of young British artist. And it was an amazing kind of arts congress all the time.
Wow, it sounds amazing. Well, I can't wait to go inside Farley Farm. We're here.
We are here. Let me get out and open the gate.
Okay, great.
Can I offer you some coffee?
Oh, yes, please. It's a perfect 1950s kitchen.
It is a perfect 1950s kitchen, and it was actually designed by my mum to do it. You didn't go to B&Q in those days and buy it off the peg. This was architect designed and built by a firm of shop fitters down in Eastbourne, and it all arrived on a big truck and they installed it. And it has some rather lovely features. For a start, the worktop is blue formica, and this was a big deal because people weren't familiar with formica and it was considered to be quite revolutionary. And then here we have drawers. You see, these drawers are cut at an angle to make use of this splay here. And then here, way ahead of its time, there's a rotary cupboard. And this was considered so remarkable that people used to come here to see the kitchen, never mind the paintings. They weren't interesting at all. It was the kitchen.
In 1947, Lee Miller married the British surrealist painter Roland Penrose. And not long after, the two settled in Chiddingly and set about creating a bohemian idyll in the English wilds. Today, Farley Farm, where the pair hosted Picasso, Man Ray, Joan Miró, and later the likes of Richard Hamilton, is a rambling farmhouse packed full of surrealist works, ethnographic totems and curious souvenirs, like a silver King Kong or a tray looted from Hitler's house. It's also cosy and lived in. In the kitchen, the agar is warm. The cupboards are full of Lee Miller's whisks and pans, and there's even a Picasso lithograph next to the formica table and chairs. As we wait for our coffee, Anthony explains what he's trying to achieve by turning his family home into a museum.
What we're doing here is we're presenting art in the home, and it's a very different feeling to seeing art in a museum. When visitors come here, they're confronted by a kind of rather scruffy old farmhouse that's actually, incidentally almost, got some real gems of the last century art on the walls. And it's less confrontational, more accessible, and people who would not normally be interested in this kind of thing, whether it's photography or painting or whatever, they suddenly get drawn in. And I find that deeply satisfying because it appeals to a far wider audience than we would if we were on the wall of a museum.
And the agar's on. It's very cosy. It's very intimate. I mean, we're having coffee and we can sort of see a Picasso lithograph. And is that the atmosphere you're trying to cultivate here?
We've tried to keep the atmosphere exactly as it was in my parents' day. So it's as though you're being welcomed by them as their guests. And I hope that's what comes over.
And so you grew up here. Mm-hmm. And did you have a... I mean, what was your childhood like, your day-to-day existence in those days?
Well, when I was very young, I was here on my own with my nanny and a very large Labrador dog. That's the coffee bubbling.
Anthony had a difficult relationship growing up with Lee Miller as a mother. It wasn't until after her death that he realised what true talents she had.
And the thing that really changed my whole perception about her was shortly after she had died, my late wife Susanna went up into the attic here and she came back down with a, not photographs, but with a bunch of typed pages. And Susanna had been acutely aware of how much conflict there had been between Lee and myself because, you know, it's not easy if you're growing up with a mum that's an alcoholic. You tend to fight a lot. And she said, "Here, I think you should see this." And I took the pages and I sat on the stairs and I read them and then I read them through again. And then I thought, these cannot be by Lee Miller because this cannot be the work of the useless drunk that I knew. And there was no byline. It was even more frustrating. So I had to go through everything. And finally, yes, it was. It was her dispatch from the Siege of San Marlo. And it was this incredibly vivid eyewitness account of an infantry assault on the fortress. And she had been watching the GIs she'd been joking with a few minutes before, mown down by machine gun fire. And I just couldn't believe that this had come from the person that I had such a low regard for. So we had to get all the boxes out of the attic. We had to sort through everything. I had to read everything, look at all the pictures. And this picture started to grow of somebody I had never known. I had not a clue of her achievements, and nor actually, to a very great extent, of my dad. And we were both astonished, and it gave us a really big understanding as to why she'd had so much egregious behaviour, why she had, you know, such a difficult life after the war. It's because she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and nobody understood a bit of it.
Lee Miller served as Vogue's war correspondent in World War II, and the memories of the horrors she witnessed in the concentration camps of Bavaria, the children's hospitals of Vienna, and the civilian casualties of Leipzig deeply affected her for the rest of her life. But to fully understand her character, you need to go back to her childhood. Carolyn Burke is Lee Miller's biographer.
As a little girl, she was her daddy's darling. So her first 6 years were a very warm, affectionate. Her family was well off. Her father was an exciting sort of person in that he was an inventor and also an amateur photographer who loved to take photographs of little Elizabeth, that was her actual name. But at the age of 7, a terrible, terrible thing happened when she was visiting family friends. She was in the care of some unnamed male person who was part of the family she was visiting, who, it turns out, raped her. And was never charged with the crime. Nothing more was found out about this person. She was bundled off home back to her family. Everything was hushed up. She had to be treated for the ensuing venereal disease with very harsh, painful treatments that were available then. And she was given to understand that in some way she was at fault, that she was damaged. And this experience, I think, underlay very many of her experiences in the future as a woman, as a sexual being, as a great beauty.
Biographers, including Burke, have also pointed to Lee's strange relationship with her father.
Curiously, a very deep bond of affection always persisted between Lee and her father, and in many ways, he gave her the support that she needed to go on to become the great photographer that she did. So it's a very mixed story, the relationship between the father and daughter.
After a rebellious education, she was expelled from every school she attended. Lee set out for New York. She was a true beauty, And, as Carolyn Burke explains, she literally fell into the arms of the famous magazine publisher, Condé Nast.
She was about to step into the street and would have been hit by a car, except that Condé Nast, who was on the same corner, pulled her back, dusted her off, and had a good look at her and said, "My dear, have you ever thought of modeling?" And then invited her to the Vogue studio, where she was an instant revelation and was put on the cover of the next issue of Vogue. So that's the beginning. She lived in a way like a flapper, as we would imagine one of F. Scott Fitzgerald's heroines at the time. As she'd already had a background in photography with her father, she quickly formed the idea that she would like to be the photographer rather than the subject. So she asked Steichen about this, and he said, "If you want to learn with the best of the best, you should go to Paris and study with Man Ray."
"I don't know how other photographers go about it, but I thought the best way was to start out studying with one of the great masters in the field, Man Ray."
"Well, that was a good choice, all right. But I thought Man Ray didn't take students."
"He doesn't, as a rule. He was in Paris at that time, so I went to him and said, 'Hello, I'm your new student and apprentice.'"
"And what did he say?"
"Just what you might expect. He said, 'Oh, no, you're not. I don't have students or apprentices.'"
"And then you said?"
"I said, 'You do now.'"
He looked at her again and thought, "Oh, this might be a good idea." And so he invited her to go on holiday with him to the south of France, and that's how it began.
Man Ray, the Philadelphia-born artist who started life as Emmanuel Radnitsky, shot to fame as part of the New York Dada movement in the 1920s. By the time Lee arrived in Paris, he was a sensation of Montparnasse, known for his innovative photographic techniques and rayographs. He and his surrealist milieu, Jean Arp, Salvador Dali and René Magritte, had just staged the historic surrealist exhibition at Galerie Pierre in Paris, 1925. As Lee Miller's son, Anthony, explains, his mother became Man Ray's muse and the absolute object of his affection.
With Man Ray, it was extremely turbulent because suddenly she penetrated his defences. And here was this surrealist who believed in free love and unattachment and, you know, all that kind of wonderful theory. And suddenly that was completely flattened out because he absolutely became obsessive about possessing Lee. He wanted to marry her. He wanted to make her Mrs. Man Ray. And this is totally contradictory to his surrealist beliefs. And in fact, it drove him to extremes of jealousy.
Some of the time, it seems that they were collaborators, that they were really in sync with each other, and that it was not just, you know, "I'm the photographer and you're the model," or "I'm behind the camera and you're in front of it." Sometimes it was more cooperative and collaborative than that. But then, because she was such a free spirit and insisted that she should have the same rights that Man had, which included, freedom in her love relationships, things got more conflicted once she was less willing to go along with the idea of being his subject, his muse, his possession. That's when there began to be real tension in their relationship.
"Has anybody seen Man Ray? This stranger tells me Man's ex saw me flirting somewhere with another man. We never lied about sex, so how is it that this jealousy began?"
Jason Carr's musical, The Six Lies of Lee Miller, is based on a book by Anthony Penrose of the same name. It helps to bring Lee's career and character, including her turbulent relationship with Man Ray, to life.
"Has anybody seen Man Ray? His friends are all in hiding, by the way."
How did their relationship end?
Very dramatically. She had met another man already, but this was only the beginning. She decided that she could no longer go on living with Man Ray or working with him, that she would have to strike out on her own. So she booked passage back to New York. She decided that that was where she would become a photographer in her own right, get out from under the influence of Man Ray and the prestige of surrealism. And she said goodbye, basically. And the story went round Montparnasse that Man was suicidal, and he was seen turning up in cafes dead drunk, and he posed, he took a picture of himself surrounded by various items of choice for one who would commit suicide, with a gun and a rope and a bottle of poison. He expressed his dismay and distress the way that he knew how in photography.
His obsession with Lee stayed with him for many years, as her son Anthony explains back at Farley Farm.
He made the most incredible drawing called Suicide, which is based on a photograph by the same title of her. And you'll notice that in the shadow, what seemed to be a series of lines is actually his signature, Man Ray, and the date, 1937, 5 years after she had left him. Was it that 5 years long he was still, like, in her shadow? The lines of her shadow? I don't know. I think he felt probably artistically more threatened than she did.
And they had a very volatile relationship. Do you think he was inspired by, you know, their quarrels and the disputes that they had as much as he was by her beauty and her spirit?
I think above all he was inspired by the tension that the jealousy and the disputes gave, and that, like I said, that's what triggered his creation, Indestructible Object. And of course there were many other works too that relate directly to Lee Miller, like his painting L'Ogiste Artiste, and also the massive painting of her lips, which is called by two titles, Observatory Time and The Lovers. And that was his farewell kiss to her after she had left. One of the best known of his whole works is The Metronome, and originally it was called titled Object to be Destroyed. And somebody did him a favour and destroyed it, and so he made many, many others and titled it Indestructible Object, realising that nobody could destroy them all. But he made a poem about it, and the poem goes something like, "Cut out the eye from a photograph of one who has been loved but is seen no more. Attach it to the pendulum of a metronome and regulate it to the tempo desired. Keep going to the limit of endurance. When you can no longer bear it, destroy the whole with a well-aimed blow of a hammer." Now, Lee thought it was like making a voodoo wax effigy to stick pins into, and of course she had some reason for that, because it was her eye on the pendulum ticking backwards and forwards.
If you want to see some Man Ray stuff, I'll have to take you into the store, which is fine, I can do that.
This is a letter from Man Ray to Lee Miller. We're not absolutely certain when. He says, "You must arrange to live as my wife, married or not. I cannot see you in any other way. I'm going through too much trouble for the amount of dissipation of forces that goes on, and one of these days I shall simply break down." You know, he is so in love with her, yet she won't commit to him. And this is what's causing him so much anguish. Here we go. "I could have taken the next plane over and brought you back amidst a scene if necessary." You see, she's in England at the moment working for a movie company in Pinewood Studios. And anyway, you see, he's absolutely burning out. "This is the last time I retire at your request." Now, for somebody with an ego like Man Ray's to say that, you know, he's going to retire, it's just really quite extraordinary for him. "This summer, when we are alone together somewhere for a long while without interruption, I shall concentrate on this subject with my eyes fixed on you and yours registering appreciation."
Wow, that's love, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I laugh now. But, you know, it was so important to these guys. And I'm glad it was, because, look, as I said, it endured. It lasted for their whole lives.
Despite their difficulties, Man Ray and Lee Miller remained great friends, and their love endured.
What I remember most about Man Ray visiting is that Lee was always so happy. It was a moment when I could be certain that the, you know, the sadness and the depression would just vanish and she would be smiling and chatty and jokey again when he was there. And there was some wonderful connection. There was a deep love between them. I always felt that it was the moment that I understood that real love is a thing of the heart that lasts forever and is not just about looking good when you're young. And that was the thing that I remember most, was the warmth of the connection. But Man Ray himself as a person was a wonderful guy for a small kid to be around, because he knew about everything. He had the best gadgets in his studio, and he was very generous about giving time and making things and doing stuff with me as a kid.
Man Ray's training was invaluable for Lee's journey on the front line, as she explained to Ona Munson on her LA radio show in 1946.
Well, I'm sure that studying with a great photographer like Man Ray was invaluable training.
It was, Ona. And when I began actually working on my own and on Vogue magazine, I realized how invaluable it was.
That was on the Paris staff of Vogue, wasn't it?
Yes. My pictures and articles appeared in American Vogue, but I've always worked over there.
Well, how did it happen that you didn't come home when war broke out?
Well, I had planned to come back to the States, but when the war started, I thought that since I'd had my fun over there, I'd better stick around and work, too.
So you became Vogue's war correspondent?
Well, no. I became Vogue's war photographer. You see, I only started writing by accident.
Lee's war reportage and photography have become an increasingly recognised part of her work since her death in 1977. I visited Gemma Barnett, print sales manager of the Photographers' Gallery in London, who sell work on behalf of the Lee Miller estate.
So here's our print sales team. Predominantly, Lee Miller is an artist, and I think when you really study her work, and if you look at it in the context of other photographers, especially other war photographers, there is a stark difference. Lee Miller's work starts with the surrealist influence at its core, but also with a sort of painterly aspect and the vision of somebody that is looking more at the composition, you know, with a certain artistic intelligence. It's not just a simple document. As a war photographer, I think she's really interesting because she came to it in her sort of third life as a photographer. So she'd already been doing modelling, fashion, portraiture. And her war photography is fascinating because it has a completely different angle to it than, you know, the most other war photographers would use. And she adopts a sense of humour in her photographs and includes a little bit of that surrealism all the time.
She had a remarkable eye for the personal detail. She could see what we call collateral damage in both a large-scale way and very small, detailed ways. For example, you may remember one of her photographs of tremendous damage in I think it was a German town towards the end of the war. And in addition to all the bomb buildings and the devastation that we recognize, we also see a doll that has been bombed, as if this is a stand-in for the human damage. There are things of that sort that she did which might not show up in other war photographers' photos.
That's amazing as well.
It's so amazing that there was a surrealist on the front line.
We do have clear winners in terms of print sales on her behalf, and I suppose the one that is always of interest is Lee Miller in Hitler's bathtub. This is not a photograph, actually, by Lee Miller. It's a photograph that has become part of her archive, and it was by David Sherman, her partner at the time. It really gives you a sense of the woman behind the photographs. She was someone that was daring. She had incredible bravery and just the need to break boundaries, and she needed to constantly challenge herself. And so it's a defining image of her career, but also of the access that she was able to get. So few women in themselves would have been able to get that access. But then as a war photographer, something completely new, that image of her sitting in Hitler's bathtub after he had died is really key to her archive, I think.
I had my orders to cross the channel. It was shortly after D-Day. I got on an LST. Halfway across, the LST had his orders changed.
And where did it land?
On another beach. I was right in the middle of a siege.
And as long as you were there and just happened to have your camera...
Naturally, I took pictures. You can't blame a girl for that when she has a battle right in her lap.
I should say not. But what about that picture of Berchtesgaden burning? How did you happen to be right up there at Hitler's hideaway at the right moment?
Well, let's see. I'd have to go back a bit for that. You see, I went in the day they took Munich. I've been carrying Hitler's Munich address around in my pocket for years, and finally I had a chance to use it.
So you went calling?
Yes, but mine host wasn't home. However, he had so recently been there that his private telephone wires were still operating, and one of the soldiers picked up the phone. I took some pictures of the place, and I also got a good night's sleep in Hitler's bed. And I even washed the dirt of Dachau off in his own tub.
People have often said to me, how did they do this? You know, how could she put her bare bottom in the same place that Hitler had sat? And I put this to Sherman, and he said, it was easy. By this time, we hadn't had our clothes off for 3 weeks, and we stank like polecats. And so here was a tub and hot water and soap, and we just leapt in. And then we realised that we had the scoop of the century.
As Lee's son, Anthony Penrose, explains, this splash in the Führer's tub was a moment of dark humour, and no doubt a frothy respite from the trials of war. But Lee's role as a war reporter and photographer also exposed her to horrific atrocities and human suffering. Biographer Carolyn Burke again.
She was so angry at the consequences of this war, and particularly at the Germans, that she felt a deep conviction as a witness that she must bring to the world's attention not only the horrors of the war, but the consequences for decades to come. And that was her contribution, I believe.
There was so much anger in when she was in Germany, in her photographs, and yet this has got so much empathy, which is really peculiar.
That some of the corpses look like this, like they're sort of sleeping or lounging, like in the new 20s Paris, and they're actually shockingly dead.
The work Gemma Barnett at the Photographer's Gallery is referring to is another of Lee's most famous war pictures. It's one that Anthony is also keen to show me back at the air-conditioned archive store at Farley Farm.
What we're looking at here is this is an original vintage contact sheet from Leipzig, and it was just after the Allies had taken the town. And this is the office of the Bürgermeister, and he has just killed himself with his wife. Here's his wife, slumped in the chair, and his daughter. And they killed themselves because they thought the battle going on outside the town was the Russians coming. And if you were a Nazi, particularly if you were a young woman, it was a very bad idea to be captured by the Russians. So here he is, slumped forwards, the wife sprawled sideways, and the girl. She's just leaning back as though she's having a little nap. But we know she's dead. And the dust from all the bombardment that's shaken the hall is covered her all over like a little coating of icing sugar. And Lee writes in her notes, she had exceptionally pretty teeth. There's something really extraordinary. Knowing how Lee hated the Nazis with a vengeance, there's a moment of compassion looking into the face of this dead girl. It's as though she's saying, yeah, I know you're a Nazi, but I'm still sorry you're dead, and you were pretty. You see, pretty teeth? Well, orthodontistry was years down the road at that point, so that was a great mark of beauty to have nice, straight teeth.
And it's deeply shocking to see that. I mean, these are the memories that really scarred her.
Yeah, I'm not going to show you the Holocaust images. They are deeply, deeply disturbing. And so also are the shots of the children dying in the hospitals in Vienna and the awful degradation and deprivation that was taking place in Hungary and Eastern Europe. And if you were to see those, you would realise that till she died, she carried those images seared into her mind. There's no escaping. When you've seen something, there's no erase button. You can't get rid of that image. And they travelled with her and tormented her right to the end of her days.
I hope no one will ever forget the subject matter for those pictures. I won't.
She was severely damaged, both by her war experience, what she saw, what she felt, and how it brought up the suffering she had endured as a child. I spoke with several psychoanalysts and experts about these kinds of trauma, including one French woman who was very familiar with Lee Miller's story. And she agreed that this kind of damage is not easily recognized and was certainly not dealt with in those days when there wasn't even a term for it. Lee Miller turned to what we can call self-medication, which included lots of drinking. You know, they all drank like fish in those days, but she drank perhaps to excess. And while she didn't give up photography, after the war, she no longer focused upon it as the center of her life.
After the war, Lee lived at Farley Farm with her husband Roland Penrose and their son Anthony. The house remains a museum, a testament to their colourful artistic world.
This was the old sitting room, that's exactly right. And people, there used to be a sofa here, otherwise it's unchanged. And people would, in the summer, open these French doors out into the yard there, a lovely brick surfaced yard. And that was kind of like very, very lovely summer's evening to be sitting here. And then as the evenings got colder, the fire would be lit and we would all sit round here. What you might want to notice is that the tray here bears a monogram, which if you look closely, there's a winged eagle on top of a swastika and the letters AH each side, because she stole that tray from Hitler's house in Munich.
Wow, so it's looted.
Just say liberated.
And there's a portrait of Picasso next to it.
That's right, yes. It's a signed portrait dedicated to my dad by Picasso. And the photograph, we believe, is by Picasso's wife, Jacqueline Rock.
Lee went from intrepid nomad to country housewife. But she created an eccentric enclave in conservative post-war rural England. She became a prolific hostess and found an outlet in gourmet cuisine, as Anthony explains.
After the war, she had a terrible difficulty with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it really nearly destroyed her. And she became an alcoholic, and she became depressive. But she saved her own life, and ours probably, by reinventing herself as a gourmet cook. And, you know, that was a moment that surrealism hit the kitchen head on, because she never stopped inventing. And we had, we had blue spaghetti and green chicken. She'd make beetroot ice cream. And there was all kinds of wacky things that she would either adapt or invent completely and give names to and sometimes win competitions with.
Farley Farm became a forum for artists. Great names and emerging talents of the 20th century would convene there and eat blue pasta and exchange ideas.
A lot of the ideas, a lot of the things that started in the last century actually began round the table here. I mean, for example, Richard Hamilton was here when he met Jean Dubuffet, and Hamilton was so impressed, overwhelmed with Dubuffet, that it triggered his investigation that became known as pop art. So when you think of pop art, you probably think of Warhol and Lichtenstein and so on, but actually, no, it started right here. This is the visitor's book here. You just have to hold on a second because I must put on some gloves.
And the house was not short of visitors.
This is the visitor's book from Farley Farm House. And I just thought we'd look in it and see how many times Man Ray occurs, because he did come here a lot, and his name will no doubt be in the pages. You see, here's Paul Éluard. He was one of the first people to come here. He's the poet. And right, here's Picasso in 1950.
There's a signature.
Yes, it certainly is. Readily recognisable signature. And then we have got, here's Bill Turnbull, the British artist. There's Paul Éluard again. Johnny Craxton.
But there was one visitor who was always special to Lee.
I know Man Ray's lurking in here somewhere. Oh, here's Man Ray. Yes. Look, Man Ray, I love Farley Farm. There are always sunflowers and a little drawing of a sunflower. It's not so dry. See, Roland? 17th of August, 1956.
Such a piece of history, this book.
It's rather wonderful in the way that it was so casually and put together with such friendship, too, you know?
She had that gift that she could be friends with her lover. She was a very generous spirit in all respects, and there was something in the way that she formed bonds with people, particularly with, you know, with lovers, that allowed her to, and them to, continue on close terms even after the affair was over. In certain ways, she and he were soulmates, and he continued to come and see her. She may have been the person who best understood him as an artist, and vice versa.
Her great physical beauty was one of her defining qualities. But as she grew older, the muse and model cared less about glamour.
I think all beautiful women who become models have this fear that the clock is ticking and that maybe tomorrow they'll wake up and be ugly and not required anymore in the same way. And I think actually she coped with that extremely well. And if she had been less intelligent, less intellectual than she was, I think it would have absolutely, you know, destroyed her. But this was the moment that she moved on and she completely forgot about her beauty. She just dressed, you know, she dressed very scruffily, never bothered to make up, never bothered to do her hair. She just looked like a scruff bag. But the point was that creatively she was on fire. She was doing all kinds of cooking and researching and creating new things that certainly was nothing to do with looking beautiful. And it was, I think, a very satisfying period of her life.
In a sense, I think it wasn't a life for someone of her spirit, really. She accepted it. She made her peace. She married. She had a child. She settled there. But I can't help wishing that she had been able to go on with her photography on her own terms. But that's the biographer's thinking. You know, you can't redo someone's life for them. And I think in the long run, she was glad of the life that she led.
She was clearly a really intelligent, exciting person to be around. She was a brilliant writer. When she was corresponding with Vogue from the front line in Germany, or when she was at the liberation of some of the concentration camps, it was her writing that really stunned people when they read what she had discovered in Vogue. And that was a new talent that nobody even knew that she had, and that wasn't something that Vogue had intended to receive from her.
I found her to be a fascinating person. I met her towards the end of her life, and I thought she was tremendous fun. I couldn't see any of the dark side in her. But then, of course, I didn't live with her. I wasn't part of her family. So I didn't observe the really depressed and perhaps angry moments that people speak of. I think she was a remarkable person if you could take her on her own terms and if you felt an affinity of some kind, which I did.
She's a multifaceted character with incredible talent, amazing beauty, fascinating beauty that was something that gave her the opportunity that she needed to really be the artist that she wanted to be. I don't know how seriously you'd be taken as a photographer these days if you'd started as a model, if Kate Moss turned her hand to photography, whether she, you know, and then she would try to be a war photographer. How seriously she would be taken, I don't know. It's difficult for me to imagine.
Lee Miller sloughed off the status of a muse and became an artist, writer, and photographer in her own right. Her portraits of Picasso at Farley Farm are arresting and intimate. But it's unclear what really drove her, or whether she had her own muse and inspiration.
I really don't think that Lee had a muse as such. I think she had some deeply, burningly, strongly held passions and convictions about peace and freedom and justice. But in terms of who inspired her, no, I don't think there was a muse in particular.
Lee Miller's talent, courage, joie de vivre, and often nihilistic impulse to create propelled her to the heart of the 20th century's most important episodes. Her Rolleiflex captured the frivolity of artistic Paris, the heady days of the Gezira Club in Cairo, and the front lines of one of history's most brutal conflicts. These images of war were her most important contribution. In many ways, she was the female Robert Capa, or Don McCullen. But her gaze was always informed by the avant-garde movement from which she sprung. Lee's ability to capture beauty and obscure detail in the thick of the horror of Europe's darkest places, like Dachau, a unique testament to a strong, brilliant, wild female photographer. A surrealist eye on the front line.
I don't really know why Lee's work wasn't given the onus that it needed to until recently, but I think that was probably part of her instruction as well, that she buried a little bit of that historical element of her photography.
I think at last we're able to see that she was a remarkable artist, as well as being a great beauty. For a long time, her beauty, her look, her relations with Man Ray and Picasso and so on, almost got in the way of her being recognized as an artist. But now I think we're seeing that her stature has been secured.
A Surrealist Eye at War was produced by Katie Bilboa and presented by Sophie Grove. Special thanks to Anthony Penrose and the Lee Miller Archive, Carolyn Burke, the Photographers Gallery in London, Jason Carr, James Nice and Merrill Publishers. Archive clips were taken from the CD Surrealism Reviewed.
I know that anyone who has ever seen a Lee Miller picture or article in Vogue magazine must want to know a lot about you, Lee.
Well, fire away, Ona. I'll try real hard to sound like a fabulous character.
Well, that would just be typecasting.